Hello, everybody, and today I am graced with the presence of Eleanor Goldfield, an artist, activist, filmmaker, and her most recent film, To the Trees, deals with what's going on in Northern California. But in the background of that project, there's the question of forest activism more generally, and the relationship with nature. And maybe just to really sort of jump into the deep end, Eleanor, you can, because you have a history of engagement and activism that goes far for this film and this set of projects, how did you sort of come from, say, a place where you're critiquing something like capitalism specifically, to focus upon forest activism in particular for this domain? What brought you to this area of focus?
Well, the question is actually kind of reverse because I didn't start critiquing capitalism till I was older, probably in my early 20s. I started being an environmentalist and I started probably when I was like 13 or 14 doing environmentalist work and kind of like cleaning up and protecting my home place where I was at the time, which was in Charlotte, North Carolina. And then even onwards to Southern California, where I briefly went to college. And I hadn't yet made the connection between capitalism and ecocide. And so my kind of home base, even I guess even more so than war, because I started organizing against the Second Iraq War around like 2002, 2003. But even before then, I'd already started with environmental activism. So it was more actually the other way around. And then when I got older, I started connecting the capitalism and ecocide. And I first saw the redwoods when I was like, I want to say 14 or 15, I believe. My parents took me and my brother out there. And I was blown away, just like anybody else is when they first see these forests. And I had already seen other forests, but redwood forests are perhaps uniquely majestic, and especially for folks who aren't used to seeing such large trees. You know, if you don't live like close to the Black Forest or something in Germany, then most people in the U.S. unfortunately don't live next to large wooded areas, and particularly with trees that are as massive and glorious as redwoods. So I've long been interested and been connected with the redwoods and indeed folks who are protecting them. So I when I started talking to folks who were doing forest defense out in California, I do as I always do, which is I traveled to the front lines of this fight and I brought my camera with me, and it soon turned out that I had quite a bit of footage. And so I thought I'd do what I had done in the past, which is put that footage together and make a documentary. This is a shorter documentary than my first one, but it is a documentary in that same vein, the front lines of a fight that we don't oftentimes think about. Indeed, I think most people don't even realize that redwood forests in the United States are being decimated for the sake of predominantly decking.
Yes, could you maybe elaborate on that, the actual sort of nature of contest there in terms of the company and companies which are inveighing upon that wilderness? And as you said already, the predominant motivation there is decking. Maybe you could sketch the particulars of the contest a little bit more, and who are the combatants, so to speak? By that latter question, I mean, who are the people more specifically defending the forest from this encroachment? And then maybe on the other end of that outline, you can tell us about the concept, the notion of wilderness itself as a counterpoint to this sort of project which is being undertaken by the aggressors. because it seems that the aggressors are working in. But of course, is wilderness an ideal? This is something we can discuss. Let me turn two questions over to you then. Questions.
You broke up a little bit at the end, but in terms of the concept of wilderness, yeah, I mean, I think that one of the folks in the film talks about this in terms of how when European colonizers first came to what is now known as the United States, there was a lot of writing and discussion about it being a wilderness. And that further promoted the idea that it needed some humans to fence it in, literally and figuratively, to control it. Whereas if you look at how humans have been with nature for millennia before the advent of literal and figurative fencing in, then we have always lived with nature. We were part of that quote unquote wilderness. And in order to have a livable future, we must reconnect with that history and make it our present and our future. And so with regards to the point of redwoods being used for decking, it just so happens that in a system like capitalism, the most profitable use of a tree that can live to more than 2,000 years old is to turn it into a deck, which is absolutely grotesque. Not that, not that if it turned out that the best use was making it into a boat, not that that would be like so much better, but I think we just assume that, oh, well, this is going to really important projects. Like, no, it's going to some douche canoe's deck. And so I think that that connection is important to make, that we are using trees that take since the birth of Christ to actually build to to a full living tree, and we are turning them into a deck that will, could potentially last, I don't know, 50 years until somebody tears down that house and builds something else. So it's absolutely perverse. But this is, of course, the kind of the literal and figurative bottom line of capitalism is that it treats things that are finite, such as trees, such as clean air, clean water, it treats those things as infinite, an infinite pool to pull from for the sake of profit. And it treats things that are infinite, such as ones and zeros on a screen, dollars, which is a completely made-up concept. It treats those things as finite. Oh, we have to protect the dollars. Well, you just make them up out of thin air anyway. So no, they don't need protection. It's like saying the tooth fairy needs protection. It's a figment of your imagination. It doesn't need protection. What needs protection are the things that are actually here and can be destroyed and cannot be brought back ever again. And so that's that's the kind of the push and pull of these paradigms, which goes into that paradigm of wilderness and how a wilderness is considered to be something negative. It's considered to be something, again, that needs to be fenced in, that needs to be controlled. Whereas the only way, again, that we will have a livable future is if we recognize our place in nature, and the need to allow nature to be and pull down these fences, both in the land, but also in our own minds. And that's something that's also discussed in the film, is that this paradigm perpetuates a destructive relationship with not only nature, but therefore ourselves, because we are part of nature. And that must necessarily shift if we are to have any kind of livable future. And I don't mean that for like other species, because yes, other species are dying. I mean for humans, in a purely, like, if you only wanted to look at it selfishly, like, we will die as a species if we can't figure out this shift.
Well, I would say that it's also culturally suicidal. Even if you abstract for the moment from the issue of what is existentially the consequence of capital's logic, what it is to be human beings is connected to a concrete relationship with the world that is undercut in a fundamental way by the capitalist framework. And you were connecting many dots there, one of which occurred to me being that wilderness itself is actually kind of a novel notion. It's a notion that minimally is appropriated to sort of justify the project of capital post hoc. The notion of fencing actually brings us back to the Enclosure Acts, division of the land way back in England and so forth. It then informs what transpires colonially in a subsequent fashion. We're just drawing many moments there today. So all I could do is just sort of buttress and accentuate your point, since that is remarkable that you take this sort of 2,000-year-old entity, this living organism, and annihilate it for the sake of your back porch. And I can't but imagine that most people, if they came into an awareness of what was being done for their back porch, would readily go without it, right? The question becomes, how do you, there's that alienation there from the world in a really dramatic way, and it's an alienation of consciousness. So maybe you could speak to that, to the fact that most people are just so at a distance from these connections that they don't even know. They don't even know what's happening. And then there's also, to me, the curious question, what is going on in the minds of the people who make these decisions, who do know, I'm going to cut down this 2,000-year-old tree to make a deck? I mean, what is going on in that person's mind?
Yeah, I think there's a lot of literature, and there's a lot of discussions in Indigenous and non-Indigenous spaces about the minds of like the mind cancer that is capitalism. I think that, I think that, like, in the film, there's a woman who's Indigenous. She's a member of the Wiat tribe, and she talks about that mindset that was brought to these shores by the people who came. And it was this, she likens it to Gollum in Lord of the Rings, this sort of like, this is mine, my precious. And I think that that's a very good, so, I mean, if anybody wanted kind of a nerdy representation of that, that would, I think that covers it pretty well. We as a collective cultural paradigm are Gollum in Lord of the Rings, and that's not really a character that one wants to emulate. And of course, like Gollum, at the same time, you can feel sorry for him. It's kind of like the Nosferatu, like, oh, I feel bad for this bloodsucker that must do this to survive. But it doesn't have to be that way. And you can, like the host, we can survive without this cancer. Indeed, that's the only way that we can survive. So that is necessarily unlike Nosferatu, to get into the weeds of nerdery here. But we don't have to perpetuate this way of living. And I think the key is, and I talk about this in the film, is we have to figure out what nature means to us. And I think a lot of us will go out into nature and we'll go into a very specific place. Like we'll go to a park, which again is a controlled nature. We don't go out into the wilderness, quote unquote, very often. There's gotta be a path. There's gotta be there's gotta be like a little nature center, or there's gotta be parking or what have you. Like we don't just go off into nature. And that speaks volumes about how we want to relate to it. You know, it's, imagine if that were a friend, like that you were going to see a friend, but it had to be in a specific place and they had to look a certain way and they had to act a certain way. Well, then that's not a real friendship. It's not a real relationship. It is in fact a relationship that is based on control and power. And of a kind of violence, whether that be physical violence or mental or emotional. And that's how we relate to nature. So a lot of people, when they say like, oh, but I love nature, do you, or do you like the ability to interact with it on your own terms? Because then you don't love nature. And I'm not trying to like talk down to people, and not, because this is something that I realized quite a while ago when I went into wilderness, quote unquote, when I first started doing these trips to help protect places, you will go out into places without paths and without roads. And a lot of it is uncomfortable, especially if you're like, for example, in Louisiana in July. Like, I don't enjoy it all the time, but it is an important reckoning as to how we relate to nature. And then the next step is, are you able to fall in love with those places? Are you able to recognize the mirror reflection of yourself in these places? And again, I'm not saying this like as some hippy dippy thing. This is a purely scientific, you know, this is something that you could read in The New Scientist. We are inextricably linked to these natural places and these bioregions. And so to fall in love with these places is no different than if somebody were to talk about falling in love with a person. It is an important evolution of our minds and our souls, however you relate to those differently or the same. And it is important, again, for the survival of our species. And when you can actually love a place, when you can actually love nature as it is, not as you see it or you want it to be, then we can really talk about defending it and defending it as it is, not as we want it to be, right? And this also goes into the conversation that people are having with conservation efforts, predominantly in the global South, in Africa and South America, where you see people pushing for places to be conservation areas. So you have, you know, the forced removal, for instance, of the Maasai in Africa. Well, these people have been living in concert with that land for time immemorial, and actually removing them is really bad for the ecosystem, because guess what? Humans are able to live productively with the land. And you see the same thing that happens here. Whenever indigenous tribes get their land back in the what's called the United States, they make it better. And they don't make it better just because they pick up trash. They make it better because they know how. They remember or they uncover these teachings about how to live with nature and how it can make both parties better when you have that kind of reciprocal, that kind of mutual aid, as Kropotkin put it, that mutualistic relationship with nature, with the water, with the land, with the air. And so, I mean, in terms of that mindset and how that is so starkly missing from the people who make these decisions, I think that's what you get when you have, you know, whoever that original Gollum was, and that perpetuates, you know, begets, as the woman says in the documentary. You just have this continuation of that mentality, and that's what we see here.
And I find myself admittedly chastened as you speak, because I have to concede that I also personally have a sense of apprehension about the wilderness. And I think that's connected to, amongst other things, the sense of what am I capable, even physically. So we become conditioned to conceive of ourselves and our bodies and so forth as requiring or needing certain amenities to conduct our life. But in fact, it's probably difficult to overstate the extent to which the amenities of civilization are not, in fact, necessary, that they are, in many respects, perhaps worse than superfluous. They may, in fact, undermine our potential as beings. And you go into these different contexts, you become exposed to realities that were consciously or otherwise hidden from you by existing in what we refer to as civilized milieus. But then this raises a second question that I might pose, to which you have already implicitly given a response anyway, and that is, what is civilization? And correlatively, you have the notion of the city as opposed to the country, which is, you know, a lot of times, and then the wilderness becomes sort of like a third term. Loosely, it's associated more with the country than the city. But you have these different terrains. Maybe you can talk about that. What is the relationship between the urban and this sphere and other intermediary vicinities And how does that all connect to our relative potential as human beings, physically and otherwise?
So I'm reminded of, I think it was Margaret Mead. I was just trying to look it up. I think it was Margaret Mead, who said that something to the effect when she was asked when civilization started, and she pointed to a bone that they had found. I don't remember exactly how old it was, but it showed evidence of having been mended. So her point was, when humans had not only the ability, but the desire to fix if someone's broken, physically, mentally, emotionally. I mean, obviously, but there's no fossil record of emotional fixing, but this idea of care. And she said that is when civilization began. So kind of flipping on its head this idea that, like, oh, civilization started with pottery or walls or whatever the hell. No, civilization started when people could tend to each other and had the knowledge with which to do so and the desire, as opposed to, you know, what's been suggested in the past is like, oh, if somebody breaks something, you leave them to die because we don't have the time or the energy or the care to bother. And so I think that that is a similar argument to be made with regards to, you know, civilization here. Well, what makes a country civilized? And there are lots of great thinkers who have tried to flip this on its head, like, oh, you should measure a country by how it treats its most destitute or its most at risk, et cetera, et cetera. And I think if I'm understanding you correctly, with regards to that question of like urban versus nature and like how do you square that circle, and I think that, you know, there's also been a lot of commentary on this, like the Zeitgeist movement, for instance, has like these great plans on like how to build these cities that are, you know, zero emissions and all that stuff, and I think that that's great to dream in that way. But again, I think that like what really has to happen first is that shift in thinking, because, and this also goes historically, there's also this suggestion when you learn in school about other civilizations, if you even do learn about non-European civilizations, that they were backwards in the sense that they didn't have, you know, they didn't have cities, they didn't have metropolises like that, like we had in Europe, when in fact they did. You know, there's more and more evidence coming all the time that for Aztec Maya had metropolises that housed like millions of people, and did so in a way that was way cleaner and way better, like in all, you know, in all indications, than the way that it was done in Europe, where you had, you know, outbreaks of cholera every day and people were dying of the plague and all of this. Like, there's this idea that an urban center, a city, must be in the European framing of that, which is also very detrimental, because the way that other places outside of Europe built cities was also much more interested in how that can work in the ecosystem that they were a part of. And I'm not saying that nobody ever chopped down a tree. Of course, part of being in concert with nature is using nature for the things that you need. And so there's no way of existing without some destruction. You know, we destroy every day, and we will as long as we're alive, because you got to eat. You know, it's like there's no way of being completely without some kind of reciprocal destruction. But what do we like? How can we exist on this spectrum so that the destruction that we're causing can also give something back, can also cause our places and our people and our non-human neighbors to exist in a better way, to have a better way of life. And that is something that has been beaten literally and figuratively out of us by the capitalism, but even before capitalism. And so this idea of the urban versus the rural, that's also that is also a very Eurocentric way of looking at it. And I would also point out that even rural, I mean, I grew up in rural areas, is also very detrimental to nature in those ecosystems. I mean, just if you drive through, let's say, Pennsylvania, just because it's a neighboring state to me, you will see that is the most fracked state in the country. But you look at it, it's a lot of rolling hills. And then, oh, you'll see like this little bare spot right there where there's a pipeline. But it looks really, I mean, it doesn't look bad. So it can't be that bad, right? That state is crisscrossed to death with these toxic pipelines. And so again, just because something is out in, you know, the rural areas does not mean that it's clean, does not mean that it's safe, or like in terms of an ecosystem. And so that too is a paradigm that needs to be shifted. And again, like I don't think that everybody needs to live in a tree. I would not live in a tree because I'm afraid of heights. And I think a lot of people think that, oh, well, if we return to nature, if we return to this mutualistic relationship, then I'm going to have to live in a tree or I'm going to have to live in a swamp. No, not necessarily. We just have to be, again, we have to look at how can we live in these places while causing the least amount of destruction. Again, there's no such thing as a zero destruction way of living, but how can we live in these places without causing too much destruction? How can we live in a place that honors not just ourselves and our fellow humans, but honors the other entities, whether they be trees or ferrets, that are also part of these ecosystems?
I think one thing that is interesting is how you remark that you do encounter these sort of tech utopias. And in this regard, I might be harsher than you, because I actually think there are a lot of times with these tech utopias that probably have their most grotesque manifestations in the movement that identifies itself as transhumanism, that seeks, in literal terms, immortality. Yeah. There is an implicit antagonism to the real, that we're just not going to accept nature on its own terms. We're going to bend nature to our will. We're going to dominate it. And part of that domination is a refusal to contemplate ourselves as mortal entities. And this seems to actually run, not that most people don't actually take that position, obviously, but there is this phobia of our of death and of our limitations and so on, which I think are intimately connected to what drives the sustainability, if you like, of consumerism and those aspects of capital which hypnotize us. This is just sort of a thought and a question. I mean, what do you think about that? What do you think is our culture's refusal to establish a sounder relationship with our mortality connected to these issues that you're sketching?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, I recently, a couple of years ago, read a book. I can't remember what it was called, but the sub headline was how humans invented death. And it talks about how Homo sapiens, going further back than we ever thought, were experimenting and were doing ritual ceremonies around death, which suggests that long before we thought, either we had more critical thinking about our mortality, or we just thought that, okay, this is a thing we should do because, you know, does that suggest that we believed in gods or goblins or what have you way earlier than we thought? Or what does that mean? What does it mean to be ritualistic about death? I mean, and they've also done studies that show that elephants grieve their dead and have rituals around that too. So the question of mortality is a really fascinating one. And I do find it also fascinating that, you know, we humans live and die, and we've only, after all of this time, we have only ever figured out how to deal with one of those facts. And that the death part is something that we just cannot deal with. And I think that absolutely, I think that the question, particularly of, with regards to technology and death, is a really fascinating one. And this idea that we could somehow make ourselves immortal, as if, first of all, you'd want to be. I mean, that just sounds awful. And philosophically, there's so much writing and discussion about why we are these emotional and thinking and vibrant beings because we are mortal. And if we are immortal, then nothing matters because everything is just going to happen all of the time and it'll repeat. And it's just like it nothing's important. And yeah, beauty exists because it's mortal, right? And so I think that this kind of fight is an interesting one, also because I think it does bleed into how we treat nature, because again, we treat things that are finite as if they were infinite. We treat these trees like, oh, I'll just replant them. Well, but that doesn't matter because you already killed. So whatever, from a scientific perspective, the carbon sequestration is gone. But also that took 2,000 years to grow. And so I think that that kind of obsession has bled into that relationship as well, and not recognizing, I like to think of it not as linearly, but as cyclical, because if you look back at so many cultures, anything from, you know, the Aztecs to the Vikings, they had this respect and understanding for a cyclical way of life. You know, that like Ragnarok, which is the end of the world in Norse mythology, will come again. At the end of Ragnarok, there's a new dawn. And so all of this is just going to repeat. And I think that that's also something that's very much missing from the way that we interact with each other and our worlds. We look at things as a linear, kind of like a capitalist graph, right? Oh, profit's going this way. Like, nothing in capitalism does this. So we've completely detached ourselves from that cyclical way of looking at life. And I think that that's very dangerous as well. In terms of specifically technology, I adopt a nuanced perspective there, because the wheel is technology, you know, the shovel is technology. You can use the shovel to build a garden. You could also use it to beat someone to death with. Is it the tool that's dangerous, or is it how it's used? You know, drones are used to bomb innocent civilians. They could be used to deliver food or to sprinkle seedlings or to, I mean, whatever. So I think the concept of technology has also been warped by how it's used. Technology is used to oppress us in our current system. And it's used to perpetuate the ills and the lives of the horrible people at the top. So I think that necessarily also clouds our understanding of what technology could be. Could it be something beautiful? Could it be something great? And I know that there are, there are some people that I love dearly who consider themselves to be like anarcho-Luddites. And I respect that, because if they want to live in a tree like Robinson Crusoe, please do. But I also think that there is a lot of space to discuss how we can also use technology that comes from the brilliance of human minds to perpetuate something else, something different. But again, that, just like anything else, requires a psychological and a mental shift before it can be used for those means, as opposed to destruction and mayhem.
Always supposed to worry about that. I think that what makes that discussion challenging is that with almost any technology, that an aspect of it is instrumental. That is, an aspect of it could in principle be used for some good action, even something as demonic as a nuclear weapon could be conceived as utilizable to stave off an asteroid careening toward Earth or something like that, right? That's the only use I've ever been able to configure for an entity paradigm. But does that redeem a nuclear weapon? No, I don't think so. Because in the structure of that armament has implicit within it a vision, a cataclysmically destructive vision that is inimical to civilization, if by civilization you mean a space in which we care for each other. So that's a kind of extreme example of a technology, but what makes the question more generally challenging to me is that within specific technologies, there are implicit visions. So, not all tools can be redeemed in virtue of the visions which are connected to them. You could look at it's there's no formulaic response. What you have to do is you have to just arrive at an appreciation of context and a sensitivity to context for the implications of those tools. And here I'm really sort of just influenced by Ivan Illich and his analysis on tools for conviviality, right? That tools can be convivial when they foster autonomy and general human relationship. But most of the tools with which we are saddled are, in fact, anti-convivial. They increase atomization and so forth, right? You can look at the automobile, for example. And the reason the automobile is deeply anti-convivial is its practicality is predicated on the development of road networks that are going to riven our world, and which have riven our world in ways which are at odds with human relationships. But you have to think a little bit about it. It's not immediately, for some people, it's not immediately transparent. The problem which arises with the highway system is that, well, because the highway system, we get to, move and we can talk to people more easily in other parts of the world and so forth, right? You have to sort of dimensionalize the analysis. But what's necessary is to avoid the temptation to idolize the technological and even to idolize the notion of progress itself, right? Because the idea of progress is often what is what's mooted in order to legitimate these sorts of things. I don't know. I feel like I'm just iterating cliches. I apologize.
No, not
I'm
at all.
actually
I
doing
think,
that.
I mean, to your point, that's why I say I have a nuanced perspective on this because I am not, I would not call myself a, like a pro tech person, or I don't even know what they call themselves, but I have nuance on the subject. And yes, there are tools like the atom bomb that cannot be redeemed and should never have been created. And yet the science behind that, the science where we figured out atoms, where that the atom exists, and oh my gosh, can we do cool things with it? I mean, we also created nuclear energy with that, which is terrible. But does that mean that the science and the research behind it could only be used for that? No, of course not. We can use that to create something better. We could use that to create technology that does help people and that doesn't create wastelands and things like that. So again, I think there is nuance on this topic. And I think that, with regards to the road system, yes, the automobile was awful. It did create a lot of terrible, terrible things. But let's be honest, I mean, so did ships. I mean, Columbus came here on a ship. Does that mean that ships suck? No. Again, it's like, how do you use them to colonize, or do you use them to discover things, not in that classic way, but in like a just, hey, I want to go out and look at things and meet people. And again, and I think that that's something that we could do in terms of a just transition with regards to automobiles. Like, hey, can we move away from the single family, single car, or in a lot of cases, several cars, single family, to, okay, well, we have the automobile. Let's make it into these buses that carry communities. Let's move back towards the train and have the train run. I know a guy who's working on something called the solutionary rail that uses existing infrastructure of the train tracks in the US, a lot of them which are derelict and because they've just been left to rot, and have everything run electric off of wind and solar. And so, okay, that's great. The original advent of the train system in the US was horrific, particularly a lot for immigrants and indigenous peoples who once again found themselves in the path of so-called progress. And yeah, I do think that we have to question progress. And this is something that I do in the film as well, where I quote Jenny Odell, whose book, How to Do Nothing, was really inspirational. And she calls it the manifest dismantling. As opposed to manifest destiny, we have to recognize what we are putting back when we destroy something that was quote unquote progress. So if, for instance, if we destroy a dam that then puts back an ecosystem, well, that is destroying a dam. And that dam was, of course, a sign of progress. But by putting something back, by dismantling that dam, for instance, we are progressing in what I would say is the actual definition of progress. And so, yeah, there is a lot of questions about what, you know, what these entities are and what they can be. And of course, if you're going to dismantle a dam, you're going to need some big equipment. Some of that same equipment could be used to build a pipeline. But now in this instance, it is manifest dismantling. So again, I think like that's why I have this nuanced perspective on technology, because I think that, yes, some of it cannot be redeemed in terms of the actual weapon, so to speak, but some of it can be and needs to be and should be, because I think the problem is with going in the opposite direction wholeheartedly, is that we cut ourselves off at the knees and we say that we can't use any of the things that have been constructed and were ever used for ill, when in reality, we're going to need all the help that we can get. And some of that help will necessarily need to be technology in order to dismantle these quote unquote systems of progress that we have made and built and thereby destroyed entire ecosystems. And so, yeah, you are not going to dismantle Master's house with the same tools that built it, but you can dismantle Master's house with tools that were made to perpetuate this system, and you can start chipping away at it. But the paradigm has to shift, and I think that is really, again, that's really what's important. It's why I also that's why I'm nuanced about it. I don't think that it's a zero sum game in either camp. I think that technology can be evil, technology can be good, and there are examples of both.
How do you, well, I want to sort of, I guess I could ask two questions. One just being the general question is then how does one precipitate this kind of paradigmatic shift or be part of such a precipitation? And then maybe we can circle back to the issue of the forest and the struggles of the forest, and you can maybe round out with some thoughts on that. So those would be two further questions.
Sure. So I think the question on how to do the shift is obviously that's like the silver bullet question, right? I think that a lot of it has to do with, and I know that when people hear the word education, they're like, but I can't remember. I tried sending it to myself. Yes. 1 in 5 Americans have low literacy skills. And this was a piece that was published in USA Today on September 9th. So this past weekend. And this is something that a lot of revolutionaries, including Che Guevara and others, have pointed out, is that people need to be educated, and learning how to read is kind of like the bottom floor there. Because how can we start to think about ourselves and about the world around us until we meet these messages? And that happens predominantly through reading. I'm not saying that it can't happen in other ways, but we don't have, our culture is not one of like, you know, oral storytelling, and we don't all gather around a fire at the end of the night like many of us used to. People read. Some of it is junk news. A lot of it is junk news, but other people read philosophical ideas. I mean, a lot of my best friends are people who have been radicalized through reading. And the fact that 1 in 5 Americans have low literacy skills, I think says a lot about our own ability to get out of the hole that we're in, which is a hole that was dug on purpose, right? Because it's a lot more difficult to oppress a well-educated populace. And a lot of people will take this stance and then, you know, say things like, oh, you know, we're just stupid and it's stupid people and it's a stupid. And I don't take that, because if you can't read, that doesn't mean that you're stupid. It means that the system has failed you in your ability to access that education. And so I think that this is a key issue, that in order for a paradigm shift to happen, you have to understand what paradigm you're in. And that happens via education, via reading. And so I think that in that sense, our job outside of the school system, I'm not a teacher, is to ensure that there are community spaces. This is something like the Black Panthers did, for instance. They had schools and they did, you know, breakfast and lunches, but they also did after school activities, sometimes, you know, alternative school activities, where they not only taught people how to read. And by the way, they weren't just teaching Black kids. The Black Panther schools and services were open to anyone. And so they ensured that people not only knew how to read, but knew what history and what information was not being shared with them that was important to their own self-actualization. And that is what is missing, even for the people who have great literacy in this country. That is a key that is missing. The ability to self-actualize, the ability to understand our situation, our place in time, is severely lacking. So kind of like my voice teacher once told me, know the rules so you know how to break them. And I think that is the key here. We have to understand the paradigm that we're in order to shift that paradigm. And how that happens, I think, varies greatly from community to community. What works in Northern California is not going to work in North Carolina. You know, they're totally different cultures. I think it's ridiculous that the United States is a nation, because there are so many different ways of life and lived experiences. So recognizing that approach is going to necessarily be different. And the only thing that has ever moved people forward in the past has been these grassroots collective efforts, whether that's mutual aid, whether you want to call it a church group or whatever, like these communal efforts that move people forward, both mentally and emotionally, are the only answer that we have. So that's where that paradigm shift comes.
Well, that's really a powerful, surprising response. I didn't think you were going to go there. I think also, like you said, 1 in 5, I imagine that is an optimistic number, especially if you expand what you intend by the concept of literacy. You know, it's not enough to just be able to read. What's really shocking is the extent to which people who are taught how to read are then cut off from a sense of their own history and tradition and culture. And I mean this along in virtually every register, right? And that severing of a connection with history and so on is deeply damaging. It's incredibly disorienting. It's putting people really in a place of perpetual infantility, right? Or adolescence at best. So what is put in mind by your response, Paulo Freire, you know, his Pedagogy of the Oppressed, and Paulo Freire, you know, literacy was at the heart of his project. It also occurs to me, so yes, you know, so right on. So not just enough to learn how to read, but also to learn to be more deeply literate. And what that takes is time. It takes time to become deeply literate, because you have to do that work. You have to read the books and so forth and become part of a conversation that's been happening for thousands and thousands of years. And we're all late to that conversation. Right. And if we're not careful, then we're going to lose that conversation altogether, which is why I am so apprehensive about the digital, because the digital seems to exhibit an incredibly corrosive capacity in this regard, where it diminishes people's connection with literacy and puts them into a state where their attention and all that is almost structurally fragmented. But this is a tangent that we can't really go too far along at this moment. I just want to sort of echo and supplement your point there in terms of what's necessary to precipitate a shift in perspective, and that is really to enter into a culture of greater and deeper literacy. And one of those literacies is literacy of nature, right? And we becoming reconnected with nature as we're fundamental to nature, and like no longer tolerating the extent to which we are alien from it, to go out into nature and multiple registers, right? Not just maybe literally in terms of going out into those terrains which we identify perhaps problematically as wilderness, but even in your day-to-day life, how do you reconnect with your own nature? That might be a question I might put to you, right? So how do you connect with the natural, even in, a more sort of ordinary setting, right? On those days when you don't get to go out to the Appalachian foothills or what have you.
Well, I think that some of this reminds me of like the mindfulness craze, and how mindfulness has been, just like anything else, has been a recent victim of capitalism, and now people are selling mindfulness. And I think so we should be careful to not try to like grab at this concept of connecting with nature, like, oh, I'm gonna, this is on my to-do list today. Like, no, that's not how we should treat it. And I'm not saying like don't, carve out time for it, but I think that what's happened with a lot of these like I saw an ad for forest bathing, which forest bathing is a beautiful concept, but just seeing ad for it, it's just like, oh, he once again bastardized something beautiful. But that is the capitalist way. And so I think we have to be careful to not fall into that trap. Like, oh, I'm doing my outside time now. Not all time outside is going to have this deep, meaningful feeling to it, or nor should it. We humans have this ability to nitpick sensory input, because if we didn't, we'd just be overwhelmed and wouldn't be able to function, right? Evolutionary scientists have pointed out for quite some time that we don't see reality, because if we did, we would just fall apart. Our brains can only handle the sensory information that has to do with our fitness, our evolutionary fitness. So I think it's important to recognize that sometimes you're going to be outside and it's going to be like a street and, a little spit of grass or something, and you're having a drink with a neighbor, and that's okay. Like, we shouldn't shame ourselves into trying to force every interaction with nature to be something like epic. But that being said, I think that part of it is just like looking around. When people ask me how I got into activism in the first place, it really started with something as simple as looking around. I looked around and there was trash on my street that people would just throw from their car windows, and I was like, well, I'm going to pick it up. And so when I went out with the dog, I would pick up trash. And then I became known as that person. And then I started a recycling program at my school, and so on and so forth, and so on and so forth. And so I think, again, like just paying attention, looking at the places around you and being like, hey, well, maybe there's like a little nook in this little wooded area, or maybe there's like a little nook by that creek that I can like make for as a little space for myself. And I go there, and that's where I sit and I just exist. And I don't have an agenda. I'm not there to meditate. I'm not there to not meditate. I'm not there to, there's, I think that's the other thing is like, don't have an agenda around it. Like just go to be, because that is what we want nature to be. We want nature to have the right to just exist, not to be decking, not to be epic looking or whatever. We just want it to be able to be. Even if it's gross or we don't like it's too hot or that's muddy, like whatever the hell, like just let it exist and let yourself exist in that space. And don't try to make it perfect. Don't try to make it Instagram worthy. Just have it be. And so I think that is that doorway into loving nature and thereby being moved to defend it. And again, in the film, one of the characters talks about this, like, we don't need to find the most perfect place to defend. Like, it doesn't always have to be the Amazon rainforest, although I'm glad people are protecting it. It doesn't have to be these superlative spaces. It can be your creek that doesn't mean much to other people, but you love it. Like, all of these spaces are important to protect. And I think that we can get sidelined and end up doing nothing if we look for the perfect place and the perfect relationship and the perfect whatever. And I think that's something to try and avoid. And again, just existing. And this is where I do agree with you about that digital framework causing us to feel that we have to make it look like this, or it has to be like this. It has to be Instagram worthy, or it has to fit into a tweet or whatever the hell. And that's not how life is, and it's not how it should be. And so I think that would be my two cents on that.
A worthy two cents at that. So, I'm tempted to ask one further question. I'm apprehensive that it just might open up too much, but it circles around the question of class consciousness, because it occurs to me when you come to issues like deforestation, the people who are driving those vehicles are not the executives at these firms. These are, my impression is that these are generally people who derive from essentially proletarian contexts, but nevertheless are sort of thrown into circumstances where they are participating in a process that I would say is fundamentally against their own interest. Perhaps that's an inept way of looking at it. I don't know. But in the process of your investigations, how did you perceive the relationship, say, between those people who are coming to cut down the trees concretely and the activists, and sort of paradox that really that they were potentially coming from a very similar space from the standpoint of class analysis, but now we're sort of set at odds with each other?
Yeah, I mean, that is a longer conversation, and I have to leave in a minute. But yeah, I mean, I think that all of these issues have to be looked at with a class lens, a race lens, all of the lenses that that have been forced upon us by this system. So I think that, like in my first film, Hard Road of Hope, one of the characters says, like, I would suggest that people not blame the people that are pressing the button that blows up the mountain or whatever, because they're not the ones that profit from it, and they don't have much of a choice in choosing that job. The job chooses them. The culprits are corporate, and the system as a whole. And so I think that that's something to remember in terms of where we direct our ire. That doesn't mean that I'm not, when we walk onto a site and stop construction of a pipeline, we obviously aren't confronted with the CEO. You're confronted with workers. The question is how do we try to walk into that space, and how do we try to interact with those workers? Whether they'll be open to that interaction is something we can't control. But I think that this is a framing that is important, to recognize who's really to blame for the situations that we find ourselves in and asking them to walk away is difficult. You know, if you ask someone to stop being a coal miner, okay, well, what's the other option? And so again, recognizing that we live in this system, recognizing that we don't have a choice. I mean, some people are lucky enough to do what they love as a job. Most people aren't, and particularly those who are the most poor. So I think that that is a framing that is very important. That also speaks to the access to nature, to these spaces. The people who have the least amount of access are poor people. You know, most people who are poor don't have the ability to even travel. I lived in LA for 10 years, and there was a boy that I met who was 17 and he'd never seen the ocean, but he lived 7 miles away from it. So this is the reality of a system that makes the access to beautiful spaces that we consistently destroy a class issue. So again, I think that the class lens is important for all of the things that we discuss and that we look at, not least of all the environmental question.
I probably can just sort of leave it there for now. Unless you had any other additional thoughts that you wanted to add. I just want to thank you for the interview, Eleanor. Thank you so much. So I appreciate it because it's really an act of grace on your part. Anyway, I'll talk to you soon. Do you need anything else before we go?
No, folks can check out the film at tothetreesfilm.com.
Okie dokie. And I'll put those links in the description. And you have a lovely afternoon.
You too. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Thank you.